Chapter 66. Petronius, after the liberation of Lydia, not wishing to irritate Caesar, went to the Palatine with other Augustians. He wanted to hear what they were saying, and especially to learn if Tigellinus was devising something new to destroy Lydia. Both she and Ursus had passed under the protection of the people, it is true, and no one could place a hand on them without raising a riot. Still Petronius, knowing the hatred toward him of the all-powerful Praetorian prefect, considered that very likely Tigellinus, while unable to strike him directly, would strive to find some means of revenge against his nephew. Nero was angry and irritated, since the spectacle had ended quite differently from what he had planned. At first he did not wish even to look at Petronius. But the latter, without losing cool blood, approached him, with all the freedom of the urbiter legentiarum, and said, "Dost thou know, divinity, what occurs to me? Write a poem on the maiden who, at command of the lord of the world, was freed from the horns of the wild bull and given to her lover. The Greeks are sensitive, and I am sure that the poem will enchant them." This thought pleased Nero in spite of all his irritation, and it pleased him doubly, first, as a subject for a poem, and second, because in it, he could glorify himself as the magnanimous lord of the earth. Hence he looked for a time at Petronius, and then said, "Yes, perhaps thou art right. But does it become me to celebrate my own goodness? There is no need to give names. In Rome all will know who is meant, and from Rome reports go through the whole world. But art thou sure that this will please the people in Achaea?" "By Pollux, it will," said Petronius. And he went away satisfied, for he felt certain that Nero, whose whole life was an arrangement of reality to literary plans, would not spoil the subject, and by this alone he would tie the hands of Tigellinus. This, however, did not change his plan of sending Vinicius out of Rome as soon as Lydia's health should permit. So when he saw him next day, he said, "Take her to Sicily. As things have happened, on Caesar's part thou art threatened by nothing, but Tigellinus is ready to use even poison. If not out of hatred to you both, out of hatred to me." Vinicius smiled at him, and said she was on the horns of the wild bull. Still Christ saved her. "Then honor him with a hecatomb," replied Petronius, with an accent of impatience, "but do not beg him to save her a second time. Dost remember how Aeolus received Ulysses, when he returned to ask a second time for favoring winds? Deities do not like to repeat themselves. When her health returns, I will take her to Pomponia Gracina," said Vinicius. "And thou wilt do that all the better since Pomponia is in Antistius, a relative of Aulus, told me so. Meanwhile things will happen here to make people forget thee, and in these times the forgotten are the happiest. May fortune be thy sun in winter, and thy shade in summer." Then he left Vinicius to his happiness, but went himself to inquire of Theocles touching the life and health of Lydia. Danger threatened her no longer. Emaciated as she was in the dungeon after prison fever, foul air and discomfort would have killed her, but now as he had the most tender care, and not only plenty, but luxury. At command of Theocles they took her to the gardens of the villa after 2 days. In these gardens she remained for hours. Vinicius decked her litter with anemones, and especially with irises, to remind her of the atrium of the house of Aulus. More than once, hidden in the shade of spreading trees, they spoke of past sufferings and fears, each holding the other's hand. Lydia said that Christ had conducted him through suffering purposely to change his soul and raise it to himself. Vinicius felt that this was true, and that there was in him nothing of the former patrician, who knew no law but his own desire. In those memories there was nothing bitter, however. It seemed to both that whole years had gone over their heads, and that the dreadful past lay far behind. At the same time such a calmness possessed them as they had never known before. A new life of immense happiness had come and taken them into itself. In Rome, Caesar might rage and fill the world with terror. They felt above them a guardianship 100 times mightier than his power, and had no further fear of his rage or his malice, just as if for them he had ceased to be the lord of life or death. Once, about sunset, the roar of lions and other beasts reached them from distant Bavaria. Formerly those sounds filled Vinicius with fear, because they were ominous. Now he and Lygia merely looked at each other, and raised their eyes to the evening twilight. At times Lygia, still very weak, and unable to walk alone, fell asleep in the quiet of the garden. He watched over her, and, looking at her sleeping face, thought involuntarily that she was not that Lygia whom he had met at the house of Aulus. In fact, imprisonment and disease had to some extent quenched her beauty. When he saw her at the house of Aulus, and later, when he went to Miriam's house to seize her, she was as wonderful as a statue, and also as a flower. Now her face had become almost transparent, her hands thin, her body reduced by disease, her lips pale, and even her eyes seemed less blue than formerly. The golden-haired Eunice who brought her flowers, and rich stuffs to cover her feet was a divinity of Cyprus in comparison. Petronius tried in vain to find the former charms in her, and, shrugging his shoulders, thought that that shadow from Elysian fields was not worth those struggles, those pains, and those tortures which had almost sucked the life out of Vinicius. But Vinicius, in love now with her spirit, loved it all the more, and when he was watching over her while asleep, it seemed to him that he was watching over the whole world. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.